From the Jerome L. Green Performance Space here at WNYC, this is a special edition of the Ryan Lehrer Show. Good morning, everyone. It's Occupying Democracy. You can watch us this morning on live streaming video. Go to WNYC.org or thegreenspace.org and treat us like TV. Coming up next hour, how to get more of the 99% to vote in conjunction with the New York City Campaign Finance Board, a public brainstorm on how to increase the city's low voter turnout. But we begin right now with a dialogue. That's dialogue, not diatribe, about the issues underlying the Occupy Wall Street movement. Please welcome four special guests, Occupy organizer Jesse LaGreca, also known as Daily Coast blogger, Ministry of Truth, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, once known as the Sheriff of Wall Street, Crane's New York business columnist Greg David, who's been pushing back in a series of columns against some of the ideas of the protesters. He also runs the Business and Economics Journalism Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, and Catherine Wild, president of the New York City Partnership, a business group that includes most of the Wall Street firms. She is also a deputy chairwoman of the New York Federal Reserve. Please welcome all of our guests. So, Jesse, what are the main bottom line messages of Occupy Wall Street for you? Many people say they can't quite figure it out.
I think it's so easy to articulate. It's really obvious. You have millions upon millions of people being asked to share the sacrifice in a disaster that they did not create. We're being told that we need budget cuts left and right to education, transportation, literally to our future. At the same time, the Dow Jones is soaring, corporate profits are through the roof. It really becomes obvious at this point that the pizza pie of our economy can only be divided in so many different slices, and that slice that we've been counting on for our future is being stolen away from us.
I would put it as you're protesting the growing inequality in income and wealth in this country and the lack of accountability by the Wall Street firms for their recklessness that brought on the financial crisis and the housing bust. Am I near the heart of the matter?
You're better at this than I am, I would say so.
I want to go down the line and get from each of the rest of you briefly your understanding of what this is all about. Eliot Spitzer, how would you articulate it?
I think, Brian, you got it right. It is the fundamental disjunction between cause and consequence of the economic crisis. The banks and Wall Street were the primary cause. They have not borne the brunt of any responsibility. The GAO report that came out this morning, I think, is at the heart of this, highlighting what many of us have been saying for a long time, which is the New York Fed played a critical role in bailing out the banks, never even thought to ask for anything back structurally in terms of mortgage reform, in terms of how we think about banking and finance. The $12.9 billion check to Goldman Sachs to get it out of its credit default swap exposure to AIG being perhaps the single worst, most egregious example of misjudgment and poor negotiating and frivolous, outrageous behavior by the government. There has been no accountability, and as Jesse said, throughout all this, we are demanding of people who have virtually nothing that they pitch in. There's no social contract right now that makes sense to most people, and we are seeing a government rebuild the same edifice that brought us down.
So you really focused on the banks and the relationship between the banks and the government. Catherine Wild, how would you put into words what the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is not you, is about?
Well, I think that all of us share the frustration of the people involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is we're not certain about the future of America. Bill Clinton, former President Clinton, was at an event up in Albany a couple weeks ago where he talked about, in history, all great societies reach a point where their leaders become self-satisfied with the present and the status quo, and they forget their commitment to the future. And I think that's happened over the last 30 years. I don't think it's a function of the financial crisis of 2008. I think this is something that's been going on for a long time. If you look at where has our economic growth as a country come, it's come from productivity, which means losing jobs, cutting jobs, you can say it's doing more with less, but it means less jobs. And so throughout our society, we've kind of lost track. And the jobs that were the the entry to the middle class in the manufacturing sector. I remember when some of my friends in Sunset Park in the 60s came to New York. They got jobs in the factories and on the waterfront and made their way up that way. And today, where do you get jobs when you come to this country? Well, there's really not much opportunity unless you've got more than a college education, and 17% of college graduates are unemployed. So you think
there's frustration fundamentally about the underlying market economics of today's America.
And I think it came to the fore, particularly during the financial crisis during the housing crisis, where the only thing many people had to hang on to was the value in their home. And then when that was challenged or disappeared, I think that's what precipitated everybody having an awakening, certainly the 99% having an awakening that things were not working for America. So I think a lot of us sympathize with that problem. The question is, can we find solutions that work for everybody? And I think that's where we're falling down.
Jesse, what's your reaction to Catherine's framing as you're hearing it?
You know, we can look at the immediacy of the problem in the last few years, but the reality is for a lot of people, this disaster has been coming 30, 40 years down the road. Whether their families or small businesses were just crushed by the avarice of the health insurance industry, whether it's the immediate disaster we're facing now, the underlying fundamentals of the economy since the days of Arthur Laffer have just literally been laughable for working class people. So
that's the Laffer curve.
The Laffer curve
that says if you cut taxes at the top, wealth will trickle down to everybody.
We've been fed this concept that trickle down is the answer to everything, and it hasn't worked. The pipe has a catch in it right here. It's not coming down. So we need to start talking about rising up together, a rising tide that lifts all ships. And the idea that if we cut wages to the bone, if we cut spending to the bone, if we just don't invest anything else and we just really trust these job creators to do the jobs for us, it just hasn't happened. It's not going to happen, and we need to really shift away from that paradigm.
Greg David, do you have any different understanding than anything we've heard so far about what Occupy Wall Street is about?
Well, I disagree with virtually everything that's been said so far. Occupy Wall Street is about that the economy stinks and our prospects are so dismal. So what did the polls say? What percentage support Occupy Wall Street? It's like 80%, something like this?
Something pretty large.
But these are the same people who last November, less than a year ago, delivered one of the most decisive defeats to Democrats and many of the policies that are being enunciated in history. Have they changed their minds? 70% of Americans in the most recent Wall Street Journal poll said that the country was on the wrong track. That's absolutely true. I think all four of us agree on it. But the idea that everyone's in agreement about what the right path is clearly wrong. So, yes, everyone supports Occupy Wall Street because, despite the statement here, nobody knows what it really stands for. If it were to come out with a specific and clear agenda, those poll numbers would plummet.
Greg, I've just got to respond to what you're saying because I've read your columns for years now. They have been the definition of the defense of a financialization of an economy, a deregulatory structure that brought us to the precipice of abject failure. And you now want to say, look at poll numbers, there's ambiguity, therefore they stand for nothing. Let's look forward only. No, sometimes you have to look back. And history does matter, Greg. You'll let me finish.
I'm happy if to you look back.
If you look at the economic history of the nation, from the period of the New Deal when we put Glass-Steagall in place and had a financial structure that was regulated, where we had wise, thoughtful leaders like Felix Rowan, people who did very well, who understood the need for a regulatory framework, caution, not crazy leverage and scraping money off the top at every turn, we didn't have the huge bubbles and crashes that we had once your deregulatory philosophy was put in place. That is what this is about. Your ideology failed. The history is clear.
Greg, take a minute on that history.
Well, let me first say that that is the worst characterization of my work I've ever seen. And for the record, and I want to say this early, for the record, I have never defended Wall Street greed. I have spent my time explaining what that greed has meant for New York, and it's something different. As for the history, this is the classic superficial history of what actually took place. And I'll rest my case. I don't know if you've read it, but I think Gretchen Morgenson's book, Reckless Endangerment, is the best book on what happened.
Very tough on the banks.
What?
Very tough on the banks.
But not as tough on the banks as it is on Fannie Mae and the politicians. Without a policy which said that everyone should own a home, no matter whether they could afford it, what would have happened could not have happened.
But
that's
but,
just not a – that is a combination of factors that led to the financial crisis. Are the banks responsible? Of course the banks are responsible. But so are many other people.
Let me take you one step further down the line of your reasoning, because you wrote a column the other week titled, Is Corporate Greed the Cause of Our Economic Woes? So is corporate greed one of the causes of our economic woes, in your opinion?
Is define corporate greed for me.
What? It was your title. It
no,
was your
I
headline.
I don't think so. I didn't write that one. I didn't write that title. The answer about – I wrote one about the millionaire's tax and small businesses, but anyway.
Well, do you want to answer the question anyway?
Yes.
However you
I'll answer the question
greed.
This way. The purpose of a corporation is to make a lot of money. That is its defining purpose in the economic system. And by making a lot of money, by maximizing its profits, many good things happen in the economy. Now, you said corporate greed. That's a different thing than individual greed. I'm not going to defend the money they make on Wall Street. I'll explain what it does in New York. I'm not going to defend extraordinary severance packages. Somebody just got $100 million from leaving an energy firm.
But I'm asking a different question. And it was in your article called Occupy Wall Street, Myth versus Reality.
Yes.
Myth number two was corporate greed is the cause of our woes. So I'm asking you, is there a relationship between corporate greed, not just in something that may be immoral, but a relationship between corporate greed and the straits that everybody else is in today?
No, I don't think there's a relationship. It is the object of a corporation to make the most money, to maximize its profits for its shareholders, and that may mean moving jobs overseas in a global economy. That means being as efficient as possible. That means being innovative.
Which ultimately comes back to the good of the American people, you're concluding.
I believe it should, yes.
Elliot.
Look, I've just got to respond. Greg, we can agree on one thing. The mission of the corporate entity is to make money. The problem is when we also let the corporation then dictate the rules of society by which they operate, then crisis occurs. What happened over the last 20 years was the Wall Street firms wrote their own rules, and the crisis was so obviously coming down the track. Every time I made a case saying there's fraud here, there's a structural problem, the response from you and Cranes and the partnership and the New York Fed was, don't worry, we will take care of it. You didn't. That's the simple underlying truth here.
Let me let Catherine Wild from the New York City Partnership, which includes Wall Street firms and the New York Fed, respond to that.
Well, it's just not accurate. You never heard me say, don't worry, we will take care of it. Never.
I will cite it to you chapter and verse in the partnership, in the Chamber of Commerce, in the Cranes editorials, in the New York Fed statements.
Well, you won't find my saying that. I think that the, you know, clearly there are serious issues with the regulatory environment. Unfortunately, we've been going through this period where there's been a globalization of the economy and there's been kind of global anarchy about how to regulate institutions. And the tension we have, particularly here in New York, because we're the global financial capital, is that we have relied on the profits of the financial center to support our tax base. It's a third of our economy. It's a quarter of our taxes. And those bonuses have been very good for New York in terms of paying teachers and paying cops, et cetera. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, the competition is now international. It's not something that the U.S. controls. It's certainly nothing New York City or state have anything to do with.
But I think his question, and one of the main points, I think, coming out of Occupy Wall Street in general, is that the financial sector has too much power over government policy. And so the rules have been gradually rewritten, maybe over the last 30 years or so, to allow Wall Street to do what it wants to do and concentrate the wealth in the way that it's been concentrated. How much of that do you agree with?
I think there's general agreement with that. And there is, we went through a two-year exercise to try, where Congress tried to come up with legislation that has yet to be implemented and keeps being delayed on being implemented. Again, you've got the tension. The fear is that Wall Street has been the goose that laid the golden egg, not just for New York, but for the country. The threat is if we do too much, we increase the unemployment problem in the country. We increase the wealth disparity in the country because people will not get any of the benefits of the support services that are paid for by these profits. This stuff can go offshore. So we're all struggling with how does America compete in a global economy where nobody's in charge. Clearly, the biggest failure of financial regulation, and I think fueling much of the antagonism, was the failure to deal with compensation, with outrageous compensation. And I think that is a real failing. And I think it's because nobody in this country knows how to do it. And if we were going to say you're going to do one thing that would make a difference, I think it would be getting hold of the compensation issue.
So, Jesse LaGreca, organizer for Occupy Wall Street, I know you're a relatively new New Yorker, but in local terms, the tension that Catherine talks about includes the fact that Wall Street generates so much money to help fund our public schools, to make our Medicaid maybe the most generous in the nation.
Not maybe.
I know Greg cited stats recently that since the economic downturn, Wall Street's contributions to the New York State tax base have declined from 20% of the tax base to about 13 or 14%. This is hurting the public sector. This is hurting the people who depend on the public sector. So can we root against Wall Street and root for Wall Street on behalf of the people at the same time, or don't you find a tension there?
There's a tension, but I think it's because we're kind of misdirecting. The reality is that you wrote something or you said something recently to a reporter, I forget who, and you said, you know, if there was something indefensible going on, then we should act. How can we not call this indefensible? I mean, the foreclosure of fraud scandal right now that Attorney General Eric Holder is investigating or trying to investigate, it's so pervasive. They're literally throwing people out of their homes without the proof that they own that mortgage. It would be like me crashing a car into somebody and then being like, you know what? Oh, you can't prove I own the car, so I don't have to pay anything.
I think you're right. You're absolutely right. The failure to resolve the housing mortgage issue is indefensible. You're absolutely right.
But stay on point, Jesse. Does Occupy Wall Street want Wall Street to do worse?
No, Occupy Wall Street wants accountability. I think not only are we we are a protest not only for social economic justice, it's also about the rule of law. And in cases like the foreclosure fraud scandal, when we have lots of documented proof that there have been literally fraud going on. I mean, it's like if I wrote a check and lied. My point is, at some point, somebody needs to be investigated for the crimes that are obvious to perceive. Senator Carl Levin used a bit of language I won't use right here, but he called it a lousy deal, more or less. And it doesn't take one senator to answer this problem. It's not going to take one law. We need a movement, because the reality is that Wall Street has taken such tremendous risk that they've put all of our livelihoods at risk, and there needs to be way more accountability.
Elliot Spitzer. And Elliot, we have 1 minute. We're coming up on a break.
Okay, I want to say something quickly then that responds to Kathy, whom I love dearly. We've dealt with each other for many, many years, but you're trying to do something too clever by half. The moment we're talking about the regulatory structure and the macro impact, you're suddenly saying, let's talk about the impact on New York. I was the governor of New York. I know those numbers. But we're not talking about New York State right now or New York City. We're talking about the global economy, 25 million unemployed people, our competitive position in the world. The reality is, when you talk about international competition, the banks always use this boogeyman. We will send the money overseas if you regulate us too hard. The lack of regulation is what brought down the global economy. The Europeans are better on this than we are. This false argument of international regulatory triage is a simple...
That's not what I'm talking about.
Yes, it's a canard. It's a canard.
It's not. It is that the financial markets are moving increasingly to Asia and other parts of the world, where our competition is no longer even London. Well, it doesn't.
We will have to come back to this after the break, because you're fundamentally wrong. The McKinsey report that tried to argue it was They jiggle the numbers, and they've admitted that.
You're saying, Catherine, that they are moving elsewhere in the world because the United States is overregulated?
No, no. I'm saying that the competition and the need to keep our economy the center of capital markets and keep growing and to attract additional capital and business, not just in New York but around the country, but my particular focus is New York, there is international competition. So there is a tension because there's no international regulation. And so the United States has to be bring along the rest of the world through the G20 negotiations. So this is a long and difficult process. Well, it's not disagreement on the need for global regulation. What you don't want to do is have America get in an even worse economic situation and have more people lose their jobs in the meantime because somebody else is less regulatory and giving a more favorable tax environment than we are.
We'll be a little flexible with the break for one more response on this from Elliot.
Kathy, again, you're trying to be too clever by half.
I'm not that clever. You're the clever one here,
Elliot. You acknowledge something here. It is not the regulatory structure that is driving financial services overseas. Wealth creation.
I didn't say it was.
Well, then let's not use. Let's not use the concern of international regulatory arbitrage.
It is the absence of an international regulatory structure
that makes it tough. Kathy, I was responding. You have invoked the concern that if we regulate too much, financial services will go overseas.
That is absolutely a distortion. I did not invoke that. I said it is hard.
You did. You keep saying
it. And we can't. All right.
I think it's true.
It's not true.
What's not true, Greg David?
It is true that that the regulatory environment in the United States is or could send financial service activity overseas.
I'm going to put a wrap on this thread of the conversation, and you're going to agree to disagree on that point. We will take a break. We'll continue in a minute. The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, live from the Green Space, our dialogue, not diatribe, about the issues underlying the Occupy Wall Street movement. Stay with us. From the Green Space here at WNYC, it's Occupy Democracy. Good morning, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer. A reminder that coming up in the second hour of this program, it'll be all about how to turn around New York's abysmal voter participation rate. And we'll give you the stats on that next hour. It may surprise you. Compared to other states, New Yorkers don't vote. We're going to try to get everyone in the room involved next hour in this conversation, and we want you, listeners and viewers out there, to be involved too. So to participate from afar, text NYC Votes to 30644, and you'll get a text back from us with a couple of simple questions to answer, and we'll read some of those answers on the air. You can also tweet using the hashtag NYC Votes, but we'll text you right now. If you text us, text NYC Votes to 30644, and we'll tackle this question next hour here in the Green Space as to why so many New Yorkers don't vote. Also, remember, everybody, if you're listening to us on the radio, you can also watch us this morning on live streaming video. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or just go to thegreenspace.org and treat us like TV. Right now we have our dialogue going, our dialogue not diatribe, about the issues underlying the Occupy Wall Street movement with our four special guests, Occupy organizer Jesse LaGreca, also known as Daily Coast blogger Ministry of Truth, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, and CNN host currently, once known as the Sheriff of Wall Street when he was State Attorney General, Crane's New York business columnist Greg David, who's been pushing back in a series of columns against the ideas of the protesters. He also runs the business journalism program at the CUNY J School. And Catherine Wild, president of the New York City Partnership, a business group that includes most of the Wall Street firms, and she is deputy chair of the New York Fed. Everybody's fascinated by Occupy Wall Street. I wonder if any of the three others of you have a question that you would like to ask Jesse about what's going on at Zuccotti Park. And audience here at the Green Space, you'll have that opportunity too. Think of this segment of the hour as Ask an Occupier. And so if you have a question for Jesse, Think about it. Raise your hand. We'll bring around a microphone. Listeners, viewers at home, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Greg David, got a question?
What does accountability mean in your view?
In my view, accountability means a lot of things. I would say at the very least investigations. And let's be honest, look at the Federal Reserve, for instance. We need a big injection of democracy and oversight into the Federal Reserve on any level. Now, I don't agree with some people might take it as far as that conversation might go. But at the very least, I don't think anybody in their right mind could disagree with the fact we need a little democracy and oversight there.
Catherine, you have a question for Jesse?
Well, I guess it would be in the context of the juxtaposition of the Tea Party movement. I think the Tea Party movement arguably gave us a Republican majority in Congress that in turn gave us the inability this summer to craft a grand bargain to deal with our long-term debt and to rise above partisanship. And so I don't think any of us would think that was a good solution. I just wonder how you see, if to the extent that Occupy Wall Street is the Tea Party of the left or has been positioned that way in some of the press, how you see the influence of this movement having a more constructive impact than the Tea Party has had on our national situation.
Well, I think the media and Americans in general tend to view things in a binary view because we're a two-party system, so it kind of makes sense. Like, well, there's two protests, it's kind of two-party as well. Look what the Tea Party has achieved. I can't see any of it. They came into office storming about jobs. What'd they pass? A bunch of abortion bills? These guys literally strapped an economic bomb to their chest and said, if you don't give us the budget cuts that we've been demanding, the same way they've been demanding the same thing for 30 years, all the social programs that Republicans have opposed for the last century, they wanted to cut. So they said, give us these budget cuts or we'll explode the world economy and let the debt ceiling crash. And what did we get? Whatever economic recovery we were taking place totally fell off the map. So I'd say the comparisons between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party are null and void. I respect those patriots who felt that they wanted to participate in the Tea Party. The people who led it that were funded by special interests that had the same goal of electing the same far-right Republicans that they've always been trying to elect, they really did a disservice to those honest patrons who got involved in the Tea Party. Now, Occupy Wall Street, we're not here to elect one party or defeat the other. We're not here to, you know, get like Glenn Beck down to tell us, you know, that he's weeping for us and we should buy his book. Our whole purpose is to have this conversation that largely the media and both parties haven't been willing to have because we don't have lobbyists. I'm the closest thing to a lobbyist that Occupy Wall Street has, and I have like $100 or so in my pocket. So I think that should pretty much show the difference between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street.
We have a listener on the phone who has a question for Jesse LaGreca from Occupy Wall Street. Hi, who do we have there? Are you there? Whoever you are, you're on the air. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hello.
Hi, tell us who you are, where you're from, and what's your question?
Yes, you can hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you great.
Yeah, hi. I was one of the main organizer of Occupy Wall Street, and this is quite frankly a phenomenon. This is a gift to us. This bomb called Corzine, who was on Wall Street, a senator and a politician. So he's a complete package of fraud. And this is what we are fighting against. And there are many more that we can just, you know, wipe them out. I got two letters from President Obama. And the guy always tells me, oh, be patient. I gave him 10 ideas how to reform Wall Street. And he says, just be patient. And just recently I got a second letter. And I think I'm going to implement it very slowly.
Do you have a question?
The process.
Sorry, do I have...
That's why they're coming after us, the Occupy people. Now they are towing behind us. I get to say, you know, that they are the ones who started this movement. And in fact, this was a groundswell movement.
Groundswell movement. Do you think that movement pre-existed Occupy at Zuccotti Park?
I didn't quite hear the question clearly.
I'll paraphrase the question as there was a groundswell movement before Occupy Wall Street. Do you think you're tapping into something that pre-existed?
I think that what we're doing now has been on the ground for quite a while. The reality is, you know, when we talk about our political process, our elections, that's really what we're trying to achieve, no matter whether you're voting one side or the other. You have a vision for this country. You'd like to participate in a democratic fashion, and you want the legislators you're electing to affect that change. Now, the problem is our system's been corrupted. I won't lie to you. I cannot find another term other than political bribery to explain what's going on down in Washington or Albany or anywhere else. And, you know, with respect to the people here who have done their part in trying to clean up that system, there's too many people who filibuster on behalf of the wealthiest 1% who are paying their campaigns, or they cave on behalf of the wealthiest 1% they campaign. When it comes to a groundswell movement, it couldn't be described as anything other than that. When you look at the way that we're cast in the media, we're either, you know, dirty hippies engaging in illegality, or we're like total tyrannical Marxists. Which one is it? You know, the fact that they can't explain us goes to prove exactly how organic and natural this really is.
Elliot Spitzer, do you have a question for Jesse?
I do. I've not only defended but been as supportive as I could be of Occupy Wall Street for many different reasons, one of which is you are, to use your phrase, organic. You've tapped into a groundswell of frustration, anger, I think it's fair to say, about the arc of our economic trajectory. I've also defended the Tea Party for the same reason. It's grassroots democracy. Disagree with virtually everything they say, but as grassroots democracy, it's a wonderful thing. You were critical of the Tea Party just a few moments ago because you said, what have they accomplished? And I think that is a question. You have changed the context of our debate. The question soon will be asked of Occupy Wall Street as well. What have you accomplished? What is it you desire to accomplish that is more concrete, tangible, definable? Do you have a process to get to that, to be able to answer that question, whether or not you can answer it for us right now?
Absolutely. If you've ever been down to any of our protests, whether it's here in New York or Oakland or Seattle, we have what's called the General Assembly, which is literally direct democracy in action. Now, it's a long process. You know, no one said it was going to be easy. It's very similar to a unicameral form of government without a filibuster. What we would like to achieve, I can't explain because it's a big democracy and I'm not the president of Occupy Wall Street, neither do I want to be. But when I talk about the Tea Party, I want to say it with as much respect because I have friends who are Tea Partiers, and I think that their leaders have done them a major disservice by getting them basically to vote against their economic interests. I mean, when we're telling America that we need tax cuts for the rich, but we need to cut all the other spending, we need to gut all the regulations. You know, my question is, which regulations? Child labor regulations? Food safety regulations? I don't want to get too far into the base politics of it, but let's say that the Tea Party people did affect a great amount of change, and we would like to be able to affect a positive change. I see the Tea Party as taking us into the past and repealing the 20th century, and I think Occupy Wall Street needs to move us into the 21st century.
Tell us a little bit more about that process. The process that the group is using, because I think a lot of people who've been following this a little bit in the news are kind of fascinated by it. The consensus model. That might work for, you know, a couple hundred people in Zuccotti Park. It couldn't work for the nation. It's going to reach its limits, isn't it? Is this some kind of, you know, attempt at utopianism that may be turning people off?
No, not at all. I mean, as far as turning people off, maybe it's a little frustrating. I can only imagine what our founding fathers were experiencing in Philadelphia in a room just arguing each other about how much we should emphasize states' rights or federal rights. Our General Assemblies can go on for hours and hours. They reconvene to the next day. They break off into smaller working groups that deal with specific conversations. The thing that really inspires me is that people are excited. I really rarely ever hear people say, I don't have the time for this. I got to do something else. If anything, they're so involved in the process, they want to engage even more. And I think that's a great model for our democracy to kind of take that other influence out. I mean, we don't have political parties at our General Assemblies. We do not allow that sort of bifurcation, and it gives an honest conversation. And it kind of does a good job of exposing the dishonesty in the other political parties when they don't want to have that conversation, when they want to shift away to which regulate, you know, if you overregulate the whole country, it's going to go bad. I have seen the exact opposite in the last 10 years of my life, that when we tear down the regulatory walls, we release the wolves from their cage and they just run wild through the environment. So, you know, we need to rein the wolves back in before they eat whatever they can catch.
Is there also a frustration among the group with majority vote, you know, democracy as we usually think of it, at 50%, 50% plus one wins and everybody else loses?
You know, it's hard to say because there's so many different, you know, I have one gentleman who keeps bringing up score voting to me, and that might be a proposal that we should look at. I think all the ideas should be on the table, other than the ones that only benefit the wealthiest 1%, because let's be honest, that's another thing altogether. But when you look at like a 50 plus one, we have a 50+1. The Senate doesn't. The Senate has a 60-seat filibuster, and that's really choked off all of the positive change that we could have achieved in the last few years. So I think 50+1, you know, if it works for baseball.
60 is closer to consensus than 51.
Yeah, but democracy is 50+1. So it's, you know, no one's going to get the whole 70%, 80%, whatever Orrin Hatch was saying a couple years ago. Like, if we could get 88 votes, then we should pass a public option. And it's never happened before. I think that when we pace those benchmarks, we take the democracy out of our elections.
Jesse, I didn't know you were such an elitist. Because you just said that the people in the Tea Party aren't smart enough to know what their own interests are, and that the rank and file doesn't believe what the Tea Party believes.
I love that we have this on tape so you can actually see the words coming out of my mouth.
That's what you said. Great. That's what you said.
No. What I'm saying is that the Tea Party was sold a pack of nonsense. They were honest people, but they were sold that if you end health reform, you'll get healthier. That's nonsense. I have no health insurance.
Nonsense. You're saying they know it's nonsense. They might actually believe it.
Dick Armey, who was a major leader.
I'm glad your people are so sincere and knowledgeable and their people are not. No, that's the position.
You're misconstruing my words.
No, I'm
not.
You're
misconstruing my words.
I'm saying
the leadership of the Tea Party. Those people were dishonest. The people on the ground who participated were suffering. They still are. They want honest answers.
They just have a different answer than you do, and you're not willing to entertain
them. Their answers are awesome. If I'm a Wall Street CEO or an accomplished writer at the Wall Street Journal, their answers are god-awful if I work at a restaurant or drive a bus.
Let me go to the room and see who here has a question for Jesse. Can we get a microphone right down here?
Yes, Jesse. I want to know, do you have any hard, concrete numbers of what percentage of the Occupy Wall Street members are registered to vote? And and what process do you have to ensure that you're getting the highest number of people registered, since, as you say, you want concrete goals?
Is that a plug for the second hour of the show?
What I do.
We'll take it as that when we talk about voter registration and actual voting. Go ahead.
You know, I don't have any hard numbers on me, but I'd love to talk to you about you afterward, because this is something that's very important to me. I refuse to let this conversation be co-opted by one party or the other, but I encourage every single person to be a voter. I think it's the most important thing we can do to participate in our society. And I think that when we increase votership, that we will get a more transparent system that's more responsive to the public.
Sir.
Yeah. Before, we were talking about whether corporate greed is the problem. And it's not so much that it's the problem, it's just it. I mean, greed is. I mean, I think about like the when they formed the Constitution, they were worried about ambition. You know, and they were talking about counterbalances and ambition being set against ambition. I just think they overlooked the whole concept of greed. They couldn't imagine economic power that exists today. I think the conversation almost has to be, like Jesse says, it's almost like a constitutional convention. How do we get that economic, unelected power into democracy?
That's interesting.
Do you have an answer to how?
You know, that's a great question. What we're doing with our General Assemblies is trying to achieve that. But as you mentioned, you know, out of 100 people, that's one thing. When you go nationally, it's a different issue. So I'm hoping that we are able to form some sort of grand assembly and national assembly, not just for occupiers, but also for the entire public. Because I think all of us, in all honesty, whatever side of the political spectrum you fall on, we are all dying for this honest conversation that sticks to the issue of where we are going as a country, what type of future do we want to have. And I think that you're absolutely right. You know, the founding fathers probably pulling their hair out of their heads. The one thing I did not see in the Constitution was corporate personhood. I saw welfare. I saw taxation. I saw tariffs. I didn't see corporate personhood anywhere. And I think that's one of the conversations we should start with.
One more. One more quick question from the audience, then we're going to take a break, then we'll go back to the whole panel. And Jesse LaGreca, I want to thank you for putting up with this impromptu news conference. Sir.
This is very simple to Jesse. When are you going to find a much larger space? I was down there twice already. There was hardly any room. I shed a tear for the country, but you need a much larger space, a humongous space, for 50 times that amount of people.
You know, we've had difficulty securing permits, and this is a frustration for me because going back to the Constitution, I didn't see in the First Amendment freedom of assembly where you need to apply for a permit. I would love to occupy Central Park. I think we should do that. I think we could occupy Central Park. We could occupy, you know, Strawberry Fields, whatever we have to do to be able to assemble in a peaceful manner. And, you know, going back to what the other gentleman said about the Constitution, some people claim that money equals speech. Well, I can buy a tent with money, so how come my tent doesn't count as speech?
We'll continue in a minute, live from the green space, with our dialogue, not diatribe, on the issues underlying Occupy Wall Street. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. From the Jerome L. Green Performance Space here at WNYC, this is a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show, Occupying Democracy. You can watch us this morning on live streaming video. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, or just go to thegreenspace.org and treat us like TV. Coming up next hour, how to get more of the 99% to vote. And if you want to get in on that conversation in advance, text NYC Votes to 30644, and you'll get a text back from us with a couple of simple questions to answer. Just text NYC Votes to 30644 right now. Right now, we continue with our four special guests on our dialogue, not diatribe, about the issues underlying the Occupy Wall Street movement. Occupy organizer Jesse LaGreca, former New York governor and CNN host Elliot Spitzer, Crain's New York business columnist and CUNY J School economics professor Greg David, and Catherine Wild, president of the New York City Partnership and deputy chair of the New York Fed. Catherine, you brought this up before, the aggregation of wealth. I'm not sure that you used exactly that term, but even in one of Greg's columns this month, he acknowledged that a Fiscal Policy Institute study showed that in 1987, the top 1% of earners in New York earned 17% of the income. Last year, the top 1% earned 44%. Nationally, the top...
2007, actually.
2007, okay. Before the fall, I think, is what you're implying. But nationally, the top 1% went from 13% of the income to 23%. Is that redistribution of wealth acceptable in our society, in your
Absolutely
opinion?
Absolutely not. It's not. And it's that task, I think, is to figure out how do we correct for it in the context of a global economy and not and have America actually be able to rise to the occasion by dealing with that issue.
What is it about the global economy that redistributes wealth toward the top in this economy?
It is that you have global competition, and so you're just not sure, as I said before, how the globe will react in terms of taking our jobs. We saw it happen with manufacturing. We've now seen it increasingly with the service economy as well. We have to figure out how we have fallen behind in investing in our education system. We're way down the list in terms of educational excellence, and as a result, we're not investing to compete in the proper way, which is a lot of the problem we
have.
Are you
saying then that it's not so much that the 1% are getting richer, it's that everybody else is getting poorer?
I think it's the combination. No, it's both. And I think that in terms of, I think many people had hoped that the part of the grand compromise that the president was working on this summer to try and solve the deficit reduction, that out of that would come a tax reform that would, in fact, deal with this issue. That did not happen. It was blown up, and my understanding is largely by the inability of the Speaker of the House to be able to control his Tea Party members. And it would be great to restart that effort and try and figure out how we fix our investment, our education system, our tax system. And I believe that Americans are pretty united on understanding it's broken, that the income disparity, this country was great because everybody felt they had a chance to get to the top, and now we don't feel that way anymore. We know that it's limited. So I think that there's an opportunity for a national conversation to fix those things. I don't think it happens by demonizing one side or the other. I think it happens by bringing people together.
Greg David, do you agree that this redistribution of wealth is unacceptable for our society?
Yes, I do agree it's unacceptable. I do think you have to look at why the numbers in New York are so skewed. One reason they're skewed, of course, is Wall Street and its enormous pay. The other reason they're skewed, actually, is that in the
But Wall Street was here 25 years ago, too.
Well, Wall Street pay has gone up enormously in that period. That's what my book's about, by the way. But, see, little plug.
I don't believe that.
No, that is. I'll read the book.
Slacking for your book.
Yeah. The second thing.
That's a forthcoming book that people cannot buy yet, correct?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, just for the record.
But the other reason, by the way, is that New York has become extraordinarily attractive to rich people. There's this wonderful Sam Roberts piece about 2 months ago in the New York Times about all these dark windows on the East Side because people only live there a few months of the year. You can say that, you know, that rich people come from the rest of the world to come and live in New York is actually only good for us, you know, in a local sense. Of course inequality is bad. Of course we need the poor to do better and the people who are not well off. And the question is what you can do about it. There are essentially four options on the table. You can tax the rich and try to redistribute the money. And I would ask you, do you think that works? The second thing you can do is you can raise the bottom through government action, a living wage and other things that raises wages at the lower end, and then you have to work out the implications of that. You can look at what is the primary cause of this lack of progress in the bottom and its lack of education, and you can attack the education system and why it's not educating people the way it should. And you should also, in doing that, ask yourself, is the issue money or something else in education? In New York, we spend more money on education than any other state in the country, and we have mediocre results. Will spending more money get us better education?
Elliot Spitzer, he laid out four options. Do you pick any of them?
You pick all of them, quite frankly. And you do tax the wealthy, and you do try to lift the bottom. You do invest in education. You invest in infrastructure. The problem, and we've been there, I've been there trying to put those policies in place, but here I want to highlight a different tension. Kathy sits here and says we have to invest in education. We have to do all these things. It requires capital. The problem is the same interests that then Kathy and the partnership in the Chamber of Commerce and Greg and his columns then go out, they lobby vociferously against the very expenditures that would make this possible.
You now, Greg, love to stereotype.
No, Kathy, no, I'm not stereotyping. I'm talking fact, F-A-C-T, fact. What I
no,
would like
your
to
opinions
do, I would like
are
not,
not
to be interrupted.
F-A-C-Ts.
I would like not to be interrupted, please. David, unfortunately, also in his columns, has continued
Greg,
to...
Greg
has continued... Greg David has
F-A-C-T.
Continued...
F-A-C-T.
Has continued to say we cannot invest in education. As you know, I was trying to lead education reform that was both investment and fundamental reform. These are things that require capital. That capital will come from the sorts of proposals that Brian was talking about that can be consensus proposals, that Jesse has favored in terms of raising the taxes on the wealthy, to go back to the sort of fair sharing of burdens that we had back before the past 10 or 15 years with President Bush's cut tax cuts. That is where these deficits have come from. That is where the inequities have come from. That is where the inability to invest has come from. That is why the policies need to be changed.
Elliot, in New York State, taxes are scheduled to be decreased beginning next year on people making $200,000 or $300,000 a year or more. Some Democrats want the taxes to stay where they are, at least for New Yorkers making $1 million a year, and not go down. Governor Cuomo opposes that. In other words, he wants the taxes to go down for those entire top few percent, even those making more than $1 million a year. If you were governor of New York today, would you sign a higher tax rate for million-dollar earners?
Yes, I would.
You know, this is a really... I think this goes to the heart of the Tea Party, which has targeted Governor Cuomo, right, as the Governor 1%.
No, I think it's the other side that has.
The Occupy Wall Street group. Has targeted him as governor 1%. So here's the issue. Cuomo has the highest approval ratings we've ever seen from a governor for a long time now. As one pollster said the other day, he's high before the hurricane, he's high after the hurricane, he's just way up there.
The millionaire's tax also wins in the polls.
And the millionaire's tax also wins in the polls. And therefore, people do not seem to care that he has promised that he has in some ways staked his credibility on making sure there's no millionaire's tax. So what does that add up to?
Well, why do you keep talking about polls? Let's put polls aside for a minute. Let's talk about the substance of policy and what will work.
No, I'm talking about what people really believe.
Greg, what are you driving at?
I'm driving at that support for the millionaire's tax is a mile wide and an inch deep, and it's not a issue on which people will actually vote on.
So beyond
because
the
it's
politics.
It's not a solution to our problem. It's not. It isn't. If it were the fix-all for New York State, our budget problems, our long-term employment and economic problems.
What if it's a fixed part?
Then we've got to figure out the other parts because no one piece is going to do it. And that's the conversation that I really thought Jesse made a good point in talking about. We've got to have the big conversation. It's not about fixing one piece or doing for one group. It's about looking together at the future of our country.
So are you saying you would be for the millionaire's tax if other things were also on the table?
I think a more progressive tax structure in the context of figuring out how to control future spending, how to keep from giving the next generation a legacy of deep, deep indebtedness in this country and this state, I think absolutely.
Before we get off of that, what percentage of Americans don't pay any federal income tax?
Don't give me that. I'm going to kick that right out.
I know, facts are hard for you, Jesse.
Hang on. Why don't you mention Bank of America? They pay more taxes than Bank of America.
Go ahead.
Not to mention Bank of America. They tend not to mention ExxonMobil. But you're literally going to the poor guy and saying, well, you didn't pay taxes. Meanwhile, they cut taxes on the poor guy. So you took us out to this free lunch, and when the bill shows up, you're like, oh, guess what? You didn't chip in.
I am completely opposed to the fact that General Electric pays no taxes. They should pay taxes.
And?
The hard answer, though, is what we have to do to get General Electric to pay taxes is eliminate the loopholes. General Electric paid no taxes last year because of tax credits passed by the Obama administration to encourage energy use.
But
they should pay more taxes. We need a lower corporate tax rate with fewer deductions.
But, Greg, are you saying that the fact that the bottom, I think the number is 47% of earners in America do not pay federal income tax means that we really should be having a conversation about whether the poor pay enough taxes rather than the top 1%.
The conversation I want to have is we have a progressive income tax, and the rich pay the most taxes.
Listen.
The point that it has to be argued is what percentage of the taxes the rich should pay, not that they don't pay taxes.
This is where, Kathy, I'm going to come back to facts. Your 47% is a completely irrelevant number. The poor pay Social Security taxes. They pay sales taxes. They pay property taxes. If you look at the overall tax burden, which is what matters, of people by the decile of their income, we have almost an exactly proportional tax code from those to the very bottom to the very top. Now, you just said it should be more progressive. That's right. You and I might agree. Eliminate the loopholes. Maybe you can move marginal rates down or up. But the 47% number that is bandied about is completely irrelevant to the entirety of the tax burden that is paid by people every day in their lives. And I just wish people would stop using it because it is so fundamentally distortive.
Who else in the hall has a question or something you want to say here in the green space? Where have we got a microphone? Right over here. Okay. Hello, sir.
Under the Nixon administration, when the American Indian Movement occupied Alcatraz, the Nixon administration decided to send in a negotiator, let them stay in Alcatraz, and work out some deals. With whom would you be willing to meet and work out some deals in order to end the occupation of Zuccotti Park?
I am not even interested in having that conversation, although I respect it, until they stop shooting tear gas at us. To me, that's my personally, that's my number one demand. We can't even have this conversation until they literally stop shooting shotguns and tear gas at us. Now, when that stops and they respect the right of unarmed protesters to occupy a public place, then we can have a bigger conversation.
I think now, we have somebody calling in from Zuccotti Park. Hello, you're on the air.
I apologize. I didn't directly answer your question, no.
I'm sorry. Did you want a chance to finish an answer?
I would like to have that conversation. I'm not given the power to make those decisions, but I think we absolutely have to. I'm not sure if negotiations is the right term, but let's say as far as just having a larger conversation, not just with the people in a position of power, but including all the people in this audience, because we are all in this boat together, man.
Caller from Zuccotti Park. Do I have that right?
Yes. Hey, it's Brendan, head of security at Zuccotti. What's up, Jesse?
Hey, Brendan. Long time no see, man. Glad to have you call in.
Brendan, I wish you could see his face. He is pumped that you are on the phone. Go ahead.
Is he wearing his hat?
Yeah. Yeah, Jesse, what is that? Is like Confederacy hat?
No,
or what is
no,
that?
No, 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 no. This is a Union Army hat.
A Union Army hat, okay.
I like the U in United States.
Yeah, he's a good man, that guy.
Okay. Is that it, or do you have something else?
Just saying, you know, the whole thing we're talking about is a many-headed hydra. So, but you can always trace it back to corporate personhood, because all of the problems that we're talking about have to do with too much corporate power influencing our government. So when we talk about the disparity of wealth, from whether it be individuals or companies or social services, it always comes back down to corporations being treated like human beings, and it's actually ruining our Constitution because
thank
it's
you.
Too
so
much
I have to go because we're going to run
power
out of time.
Money.
How about number one agenda item, constitutional amendment to repeal Citizens United?
I'd absolutely stand behind that. Absolutely.
Number one.
I wouldn't say number one. If I had to have like my top 10 list, it would definitely be towards the top of the 10. I'd say this, that we used to have a system in America where people were considered the property of others. Now we have a system where property is equivalent to people. And I think that that disparity in reality has led to a lot of the inequalities that we see in this country.
Exactly.
Listeners, Brendan, I have to go, but thank you for calling. I want to thank everybody who's here in the green space for participating in this hour. I want to thank our guests, Catherine Wild from the New York City Partnership and the New York Fed, Crane's New York business columnist and CUNY J School professor Greg David, former governor Elliot Spitzer, Occupy Wall Street organizer Jesse LaGreca. The dialogue continues online. Thank you all very much for participating in a dialogue, not diatribe, on the issues underlying Occupy Wall Street. Next up, we continue from the green space on how to get more of the 99% to vote. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.